Off in the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free. The sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear. It's true, it's the blue frontier.
Welcome to Rising Tide, the Ocean Podcast. This is David Helvarg, and I'm happy to reunite with our co-host, Vicki Nichols-Goldstein of the Inland Ocean Coalition. Welcome back, Vicki.
I'm delighted to be here. Thanks, David.
Blue Frontier's new award-winning documentary, Sequoias of the Sea, is now showing at various film festivals, and I'm about to finish writing The Forest in the Sea, my book on kelp forests that will be out next spring with Island Press. So, seems like a good time to talk with Tom Ford, Tom, CEO of the Bay Foundation, director of the Santa Monica Bay National Estuary Program, among other things he does. Studying and working with kelp since 1998, his group's helped restore some 75 acres of kelp forest off of Palos Verdes, California, possibly the largest successful effort in the Americas to date. And they're also involved with reintroducing lab-reared endangered white abalones to their native kelp forest habitat in Southern California. So lots to talk about today, but first, blue news you can use. Would you like mercury with your tuna? Because President Trump's Environmental Protection Agency has plans to weaken a regulation requiring power plants to reduce emissions of mercury, a neurotoxin that impairs brain development, according to the New York Times. Coal-fired power plants have long been identified as the main source of mercury in seafood. And if the nightmare of mercury poisoning isn't enough to scare you, the EPA also plans to eliminate any limits on greenhouse gases from power plants. This is part of President Trump's declared energy emergency that seeks to promote fossil fuel extraction while penalizing the carbon-free clean energy sector, including offshore wind, and its more than 400,000 U.S. workers whose jobs are now at risk. So, to reiterate, more mercury in seafood, more global warming, fewer jobs. And to quote Scoop Nisker, if you don't like the news, go out and make some of your own. Now back to the program. So Tom, again, welcome to Rising Tide, and let me ask you what your first exposure to the ocean was.
My first exposure to the ocean occurred on the Intercoastal Waterway in New Jersey. We were heading to the coast to go to the Jersey Shore. I grew up in eastern Pennsylvania, surrounded by cows and corn. I was in high school, and I ran over to the chain link fence of the parking lot, looked through it, and there was a gaggle of horseshoe crabs that were mating, and I shrieked. What? People came running over, like maybe thinking a body had washed up or something. And I was like, "What? What are those? What's going?" They're like, "There's no horseshoe crabs, you idiot!" You know. Another hour later, kicking around, catching my first waves out there on Long Beach Island, and never looked back ever since then.
So after your first high school encounter with these horseshoe crabs, I mean, did that move you? Did that ocean encounter move you to like study oceans or?
Oh, yeah. You know, I think that that's fair, David. You know, my high school yearbook, you know, there was Save the Whales. Saw my first humpback off of Cape Cod, leaving out of P-Town up there, leaning over the rail, stared right down the blowhole of that animal, which if you've never been exhaled upon by a large whale, it's something to remember.
A pungent moment.
Yes, sir. And then went on to study biology at the University of Rhode Island. Ended up chasing sea turtles because I got really tired of microscopy. And once the sea turtle pursuits off the coast of Georgia started to dry up, I was also digging clams for a living out of Narragansett Bay to pay the bills. Cawhagging, as we would say it.
But were you doing that underwater? Because I grew up clamming at a low tide, where you're just like scooping it up. So were you diving at the time?
There was about five or six of us that were using scuba to access the bottom. Hundreds of people participate in that fishery. It was an open fishery at the time. And, you know, it was an easy way to make a few bucks. But most folks were bull raking off of skiffs. You know, we were going through six tanks a day. The dives were maybe about a half hour long because it was fairly vigorous activity. And, you know, again, loved every minute of it. So, again, finding ways to spend time on the ocean and under the ocean started teaching in public aquariums shortly after graduating and then working on the exhibits, trying to introduce folks to their marine neighbors in Norwalk, Connecticut, and then made it out to L.A. in 98.
And how'd you get out to L.A.? What took you out there and how'd you get to
in my Ford now? Pickup truck, David. I don't think that's the question you're asking. There was an opening at the UCLA Ocean Discovery Center, which was a small aquarium located at the Santa Monica Pier that had been built entirely for education purposes for kids.
I've been there, and it's some of the most one of the most educational exhibits I ever saw was there. They had two tubes with pumped water, and one had a live jellyfish in it, and the other had a plastic bag. And behind was a big mural of a sea turtle, and you could instantly see how they might mistake a plastic bag for a jellyfish and eat it.
Yeah, exactly right. So I was working there for about 4 years and, you know, getting to know this incredible town. I had a little apartment down in Venice Beach. And, you know, I started to get acquainted with L.A. and learning the many liabilities that this city's infrastructure created in the way of interfering with coastal systems and water quality. And after, you know, nearly a decade at that point of largely education, I was like, I need to get my hands back into something more tangible. And if you've ever dove in giant kelp forests, which I know you have, Dave, because we were just there, you know how unbelievably beautiful they can be.
I know. It's like in a rainforest, just looking up and seeing those amazing fronds and the fish swimming overhead of you. It's really magical. It's a little chilly.
Cold and visibility's on and off, and you can get entangled. And so you started looking at kelp, and then you started working on kelp.
Yeah, that's correct, David. So the, you know, those questions about what was driving kelp forests and, you know, that variability that you just described, that, you know, the day to day, like, whoa, I was here yesterday and it was glorious and shafts of light, and I'm here today and it looks like somebody stirred up a bottle of Yoo-hoo and I'm swimming around in the bottom of it. Just really captured my curiosity.
And so for those of you who are not brought up in New Jersey, Yoo-hoo is a brown chocolate drink with no visibility.
Yes, Google the YouTube, Yoo-hoo, yeah. So, you know, working for UCLA at the aquarium, as I was, you know, gave me access to the university. And they were like, you know, hey, kid, you're smart enough to work here. You're smart enough to be a student here. So I entered grad school with the intention of just trying to figure out what makes a kelp forest tick. And fortunately, here in Southern California, with the richness of the UC system and Cal States and private university, man, we studied this place so thoroughly that there was a tremendous amount of resources. And between my own observations and early work trying to restore kelp forests and then all that research, I was like, hey, we don't have all the answers, but I think we've got enough of them where we could reverse the trends on this. And I don't think I was imagining that we were switching a phase shift to an alternative stable state. It was much more modest than that. But as the results of the work started to pile up and the impressions that I was making on myself and the others involved in this, I knew that we were onto something big from human standpoint, interacting with these systems, as well as something that was going to benefit the ecology and the working landscape that our bay is.
So at that point, you were working with Baykeeper?
Yeah, that's right. I was hired on at Santa Monica Baykeeper at the time. We had a boat. Folks were already asking some questions about kelp restoration. When I showed up, I started volunteering with them. And when I was a volunteer, I was helping write grants. I mean, we were doing it all, trying to put together an early plan on what we could do to try to put things back together. And in this case, the push came from the tail end of the 97-98 El Nino, which was really, it was a cooker. And, you know, the kelp off of Malibu was just gone.
Was that a result primarily due to the warming of the ocean, or were there other, like coastal development, sedimentation, other pollution problems that were compounding the impact and the decline?
Yeah, so that Vicky, you have run to the heart of the matter right there. There are these cumulative impacts of those stressors. And I think oftentimes in an academic setting, someone's trying to, you know, calm the noise down, eliminate the variables and ask like what one of those is doing. Doesn't always play well in the real world when, hey, it's all that's going on. In this case, it was the heat that drove that. We did see this abundance of sea urchins on the bottom, which grazed the kelp, and that looked like too many. And I was like, all right, well, if the heat goes away, then this presence of these urchins is still at a very high abundance, probably going to be enough to suppress the recovery of the kelp. And, you know, we just kind of walked at it at that. I don't want to, you know, bury the lead or not answer your question, Vicky. And I think what it came down to over, you know, the decades that we've been doing this is like, these other things are still happening. We still have water quality issues. We still have alteration of sediment, nutrients, and all of these other elements, but it was a loss of ecological control. Too many herbivores in our system dominating these reefs. And once we were able to get them under control, the kelp has come back, and it continues to come back from periodic things like storms and warm weather events and the such.
And this is one of the things you sort of discovered there, I guess. So when you talk about phase shifts, it's, you know, you get an event where the kelp goes away, but then if there's so many urchin, it becomes an urchin barrens or, you know, turf algae in some places. But your work in the late 90s, you realized if you reduce these urchin barrens, these abundance of purple urchins down to 2 per square meter, that gave enough space for the kelp spore to come back and resettle and regrow. Is that pretty much it?
Yeah, that's a great summation of it, David.
Do you love the salty characters and ocean champions we have on The Rising Tide? So do we, and we're dedicated to bringing inspiring stories and voices that make waves. But here's the catch. We need your support to keep the tide rolling. A tax-deductible donation at bluefront.org will help keep The Rising Tide on the air and online. If you're ready and able to amplify these salty voices for the sea, dive in with a donation, big or small. Visit bluefront.org and join the movement. And now, back to the show.
It's interesting because over the decades of development and runoff and pollution, you sort of lost a lot of the kelp, and then you had 97, 98. But now we're in this global context where there are all these marine heat waves that seem to be the drivers of kelp loss and urchin barrens. And or if not urchin barrens, back east in New England, it'll be like, you know, other algaes coming in, turf algaes. But you've got a depth of experience there, and it seems like there's lots of experiments going on, but that kelp actually, if you get the urchin populations down, kelp comes back. I mean, that's oversimplifying. Seems like that's what you're experiencing in the work.
Yeah, if there was a grand mystery to explore here, I'd be happy to share it with you. But not just our experience working in kelp forests, but in other natural systems or habitats. Oftentimes, the biggest thing we need to do is just give Mother Nature a little bit of space and a little bit of time, and then help curate those early successional phases. And then we'll end up back with something that resembles what was there historically, or, you know, in many cases, when we're working with eelgrass in sandy bottoms, or when we're working in sand dunes along the coastline, I'm not restoring something that once existed there. I'm putting something that can persist there because that space is now available.
But there's something of an engineering or capacity or scalability issue here, which I'd like you to talk about, which is you had to remove a few million urchins to get the space for the kelp to come back. And how'd you do that? And who did you do that with? And
how do you create that balance?
So those early days in Malibu, we were a small, dedicated group of volunteers and, you know, one or two paid folks. And we were working on a small section of reef, and we were never really able to clear the entirety of that reef. So we called it the Western Front. When we came out there, the urchins that were on the still barren side of the reef were always coming at us. So we just kind of sweep that area through to defend what we had already restored. a lot of the research that I was referencing showed the permanence of larger kelp beds. So over time, they stay there. They retain their size. The bigger they are, often the more resilient they are to some of these stressors. So it just drove us to like, hey, we've been doing this at a small scale and it's been working. So we found interest and support from folks with the Montrose Settlements trustees who were trying to create more fishing opportunity for folks, fishing opportunity that was lost due to the discharge of DDT and PCBs onto the Palos Verdes shelf. And we said, hey, you know what? We think we could put back kelp forests out there at, to, you know, back to their historic extent.
And that was a lawsuit, just so people don't get confused what that is, the Montrose.
That was a lawsuit against the Montrose Chemical Company that left a Superfund site on the bottom of the seafloor. And we were using that as the funding source to scale up our work at Palos Verdes. So with their support and a lot of public process led to a lot of questions that we had to ask and answer, led to us realizing that we could provide real discernible benefits to local fisheries. And the one plea that I had throughout all of those permitting and other public processes was like, pretty please, if we can develop enough funding here, we could do it all, and we should. We shouldn't leave spaces behind. And we measure those spaces in a 10 square meter area. So every 10 square meters of a Southern California kelp forest is the unit by which a kelp forest either persists or starts to fail. And with that approach in mind, we have moved in a systematic manner over those 75 plus acres that David talked about. We've employed our commercial sea urchin harvesters. We've got a bunch of kids who are scientific divers looking to become biologists joining us. All in all, it's 12,000 hours underwater getting the job done over the past now 12 years.
Fantastic. Can you tell us a little bit about your ab lab and how that ties in with your restoration efforts and how you collaborate with other regions, other states?
So we had the opportunity to aid in the recovery of the prevention of extinction of the white abalone. And to do that, we rely on many partners up and down the state of California. So the commercial abalone farms in California shared their intellectual property on how to spawn. What do you do to get them fat and happy? How do you trick them into reproducing? How do you settle out the larvae? How do you care for them right after that? Folks up at the Bodega Marine Lab with UC Davis took in some of the remaining white abalone that, you know, teams of us could find in the ocean, have cared for them, spawned them, and now those abalone and a few other species from other places are making their way to our lab in San Pedro, California. So we take care of them in our lab for, you know, a few months to over a year, get them acclimated to this water, get them acclimated to the diet that they're likely going to forage from, which is the kelp. And once they seem to be well acclimated and they check out by the veterinarians, making sure that we don't have any diseases or anything that are concerning, we stick them in commercially available oyster grow out pods that you would use in aquaculture. We bring them down to the ocean floor. We stuff those things full of food for them for a couple of weeks. We come back, open them up, let them crawl out. We're playing around with some different release mechanisms and timing. But we're close to 9,000 or so of those abalone going out of our lab onto these reefs in Palos Verdes. Similar efforts happening down off of Point Loma as well.
And they're protected, so we don't have to worry about poachers, hopefully.
I mean, we hope that they're not going to experience any poaching. We try to not be overly specific about where we're putting them out there and go through some efforts on that. But I think that the making sure that people know that abalone were part of the story of human existence along this coastline for 15,000 years is very powerful. And I'd rather have more folks know about it than keeping my lips too tightly pursed and not to avoid the possible poachers.
And they're also pretty cryptic. They hide away. They're used to hiding from octopus and sheepheads. So they seem to be doing a pretty good job. And despite their very great success with support from groups like the Bay Foundation in getting them back out into the wild, all their funding is now threatened by the Trump administration. And just read that they're at risk of not being able to continue the lab operations. So this is, maybe we should ask you in terms of the estuary down there and federal dollars coming in to help protect our coastlines and restore them. Are you facing that problem also?
We are certainly facing some of those same problems. This administration does not seem to be very interested in types of natural resource protection. Science, not to borrow Al Gore too strongly, but can produce inconvenient information. And I think that folks are going like, hey, we'd just rather not hear a lot of that right now. So we are certainly concerned that we could lose, you know, as much as 90% of our funding, depending upon the project or the work that we're doing.
Do you have community engagement that could help you? I know that you've developed relationships with fishermen, community groups, kids.
We are certainly trying to strengthen our partnerships, Vicki, and trying to diversify our funding streams. So a lot of foundations, other folks that might be able to help us fill some of these gaps, at least in the short term, is certainly on our to-do list. It's been a busy 2025. Interestingly, one of the last things that President Trump did in his last administration was reauthorize our program. So trying to make sense out of it at times, I think, can be challenging for me.
And even though California is maybe on the president's enemies list, California is really proof that a healthy ocean helps build a healthy economy. I mean, California and the coast really are an example of do good by the ocean, you do good by us all.
So looking ahead, given the caveats of funding and all of the other challenges you're addressing, what are some of your long-term goals for your key projects?
I would certainly hope that we can continue to follow what has been, you know, that science that has, you know, what the great part about science is every now and then it just does really elucidate the truth. When you finally get down to it and you say, wow, you know, the kelp forests of California, which is one of the most spectacular natural systems that you can look at on this planet, and realize that they depend on 10 square meters. That's the unit by which they succeed or fail. That is something that we as people can aid in, intervene, protect, manage. And when the conversations about the abalone come up, going, oh my gosh, man, there's no way you're going to get abalone back out there in the ocean. I was like, really, how do you think we should get the abalone back out there in the ocean? They're like, what are you going to do? Drive around in a bunch of little boats and put them back on the ocean floor? I'm like, it's exactly how they came out. Bunch of folks going out there with little boats and scooping them off the rocks. Now we're just going to put the abalone in the boat at port and go out there and put them back.
I love it.
And we probably don't have to go everywhere to do it. So some of the, you know, really just face value foundation of how we can go about this work and the results that it produces is to continue to give me confidence. And I'm just forever optimistic about where this goes.
Let me ask you a last leading question, which is, what was your last favorite kelp dive?
My last favorite kelp dive, I was actually out at Catalina with you. And we were in Strawberry Cove out at Santa Catalina Island. We were, you know, about 75% out, heading west along that magnificent rock. This cove has two, you know, rocky headlands sticking up, and just to the west of it's this large, expansive beach that's mostly sand, a little bit of cobbles. The rocks that have, you know, crumbled, fallen into the sea there are, you know, 3 meters to tall, you know, 5 meters on an aspect, lots of crannies, grooves, and all that, all those changes in that physical environment affect how the water moves through the area, how the sediment moves through the area. And so there's little pockets of protection and all these little micro habitats. And fortunately, the way I shared it with you when we got out of the water, dude, I was like, well, there it is, man. If you needed to see a kelp forest in, you know, 40 minutes, that was it. So
rays, orange, big orange Garibaldis, all sorts of algaes and nudibranch and amazing.
Yeah, gorgonians sticking out on the edge of the reef where more exposure to the currents. So it was glorious. The surf grass, which is, you know, actually a flowering plant that clings on to the rocks in the surf zone. And this place was persisting down to depths of like 30 feet, 10 meters, which is about as deep as I ever see it. And some of those abalone looked like manhole covers. I mean, those were some very mature individuals in there. So super beautiful.
That rays, it was all, I got to say.
When that ray was almost as big as you.
Yeah. He's a big guy and or gal. And when we came back.
It was a he.
It
was.
You're the expert. He was in my face, man. We got up. We were floating around just in our like rubber duckies after we stripped our gear off. Beautiful day. Got back in the boat and there's a 750-pound male bull sea lion passes by with a big bite scar on his side just to remind us we're not the top predators, you know. If there's not something bigger and meaner than you are out there, it's not really wilderness. So,
well, Tom, this was a great interview, and thank you so much for sharing your experience and your expertise. Tom Ford, Chief Executive Officer at the Bay Foundation, thank you for joining us on the Rising Tide Ocean Podcast.
Thank you, Vicki. Thank you, David. It was a great afternoon.
Thank you for joining us on the Rising Tide Ocean Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review or share it with your friends and other ocean lovers. Follow us on Instagram and visit bluefront.org for more updates and additional resources. Rising Tide is a production of Blue Frontier, co-hosted by David Helvark and me, Vicki Nichols-Goldstein of the Inland Ocean Coalition, with production support from Holden Hardcastle of Fluid Studios, Natasha Benjamin, and Nick Paz, and editing services provided by Charles Landon of Studio Cape May. Thanks for listening, and until next time, stay hopeful and stay salty.
Off in the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free, the sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear, it's true. It's the Blue Frontier. Tear, tear. Off in the salty ocean, off to the Blue Frontier.
Sparky, come here, buddy. Sparky. There you are. Good boy, Sparky.